Hello, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Newborn Libertarian. This is your host, Kim, and today, of course, I have my co-host, Christian. Welcome, Christian, as usual.
Hey.
And I, of course, once again have Thurman and Tim.
Hey.
What's going on?
And thankfully, we have a new guest on the show, and we didn't get to do it last time because we didn't have anybody new, but we have a guest that was invited on, somebody I would like to be able to allow him to give his story and introduce himself. Can you go ahead and speak up there for us, David?
Yeah, hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're glad to have you.
Yep, absolutely.
So, David, if you don't mind, can you understand your political background is different from ours. So you come from, well, I guess, Tim, you were the one who invited him on, right? So maybe you should take it away here.
Say that one more time.
I said maybe you should take it away here because I just met David, technically, about a couple minutes ago. So
Yeah, Dave and I met, I think I was in around middle school. We went to the same school, which was a 12th through K school. Not sure how much older you are actually than me, Dave, but he was actually my group leader in the church setting. I think we ended up playing WoW together, and that's really how we kind of, if you want to call us friends, kind of were friends.
Yeah. Yep.
Dave and I say, would differ pretty greatly in our political views, social views, economic views. So I always find it interesting to have a chat with Dave pretty much on whatever topic we're arguing about, but it's usually pretty civil and it's always enjoyable, and I'm glad that he could join us today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And, well, should I call you David or Dave? Which one do you prefer?
Either one's fine. Dave is good.
You can just call me Awesome. Or just call me Kim, because I could just be leading you to a lie right then by calling me Awesome. Anyway, so if you don't mind, can you just go ahead and tell us your political views so we can just get an understanding of where you're coming from?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I tend to align more or mostly with, you know, the majority views of the Democratic Party. I guess I call myself a liberal. I kind of feel like, in all honesty, most people are somewhere near the middle. My view on libertarianism is, I voted for Ron Paul back in the day and read Atlas Shrugged and thought pretty highly of it. And it seemed to me, because I was coming from a conservative background like Tim, and as I kind of left that and started moving away from the church and my conservative views, I kind of started realizing that basically the way I'd been thinking about everything was wrong. And what that led me to was libertarianism, which has a lot of things that I completely agree with. So for the most part, libertarians are kind of, don't screw with us, and we won't screw with you, which is, you know, a good place to start. And I kind of feel like right now the Libertarian Party, I guess there are some estimates that it's around 10% of the country. I think it's kind of the direction the Republican Party is going. I think the Republican Party is slowly dying. The Libertarian Party will take that spot. But, yeah, I guess I tend to align more with the liberal side of things just because I see government as a necessary function. It's a tool that we designed to help us, you know, create social structures and establish, you know, like norms and behaviors that we can all live with. And a lot of those are aligned with libertarian principles as well. But I see it as more of a tool. You know, albeit a tool with its flaws, it's an imperfect system created by imperfect people, and it's in constant need of update and change. And, you know, I know there's seems like a big backlash from the libertarian side of things, because there's a lot of government overreach and there's a lot of corruption, and yeah, there is a lot of waste, and nobody's in favor of government waste. Everyone's in favor of transparency and eliminating corruption in government. Nobody's on that side, except, you know, maybe the Republicans. But yeah, so I guess I'm I'm more aligned with that side of things because I think the government's an important tool, and I don't want to neuter it. I just want to make it transparent, and I think that's becoming increasingly easier with technology. So.
All right.
I tend to agree with a lot of what David said here. You know, you said he did vote for Ron Paul, so you're probably definitely anti-war. That's something that libertarians and the left in general share. You're most likely anti-drug war, you know, kind of ending the war on drugs and this ridiculous prohibition that criminalizes peaceful people. And you're, am I wrong to say that you're probably against corporate welfare? That's something that also you would be in common with libertarians.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I kind of feel like a big point that gets missed is, so we don't want government overreach. Obviously, we have to rein that in. But if you rein it in too much, then there's tons and tons of room for corporate overreach. And that's basically the way the economy is run up until now. And so, you know, we're both in favor of, you know, big entities not manipulating little people and not interfering. We agree with that. I think we disagree that the corporate side of that is just a bigger problem.
Okay. That goes in line with a lot of what I've kind of experienced from that point of view. But where it gets me, where I kind of break, or libertarians tend to break with the progressives, is that libertarians and progressives, we both see that the that corporations influence government, and they lobby and they do all things for subsidies for their benefit of their own interests at the expense of other actors in the marketplace. So, for instance, you know, you get a big company, a big oil company, kind of lobbying for subsidies and regulatory laws that keep smaller producers out of the market or harder for them to come in. Do you see that kind of the same way as we do?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. That, you know, corporations get a lot of the benefits that should be being distributed elsewhere.
So since we agree there, I think the disconnect is that it seems from the progressive side, what we hear is because corporations buy government, somehow the answer is more government for them to buy. Can you kind of explain, is that wrong? Is that, you know, because you kind of hear whenever there's a problem, you always hear, oh, we need more regulation. Where the libertarian would say, well, the reason there's this problem is because this person has a special benefit due to the regulation. If you want more regulation, you're just giving more power to the people who buy government anyway.
Can you repeat that question a little bit?
Yeah. Sorry. So basically, Bernie Sanders has come out and said that it's his belief that corporations influence government and use that influence to kind of give themselves special benefits at the expense of everyone in the market. And I think he's correct. But can you kind of explain the mindset why, if corporations are buying government, and we know they are, for their own benefit, why making the government bigger and giving them more power to regulate is a good thing?
Yeah, so I think the government size is something that's sort of organically generated by the needs of the society. So I'm not necessarily saying, like, I think government has had to expand its role because, you know, in 1950 there were 2.5 billion people. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
So in 1950 there were 2.5 billion people on the planet, and now there are close to 7. Along with that, you know, expanded lifespans, increased needs for different social programs. And of course we don't want to be wasteful with our resources. Of course we don't want, you know, fraud and overreach and money being able to buy politicians, which is essentially what we have now. So I think libertarians and liberals agree Citizens United is something that we need to maybe I'm incorrect about that, but that's something that is important to address, the issue of money in politics. Because obviously that corrupts things, and we want our government to work for us and not to be, you know, invasive. But the reality is we live in a different world, than the one the founders of our country existed in. There are much different needs They had plenty of great ideas, but they were flawed humans. I mean, they didn't eliminate slavery, for crying out loud. I think that the need for government to expand is just sort of an organic one and not like an agenda-driven thing.
But
that's good to hear where you come from and kind of how that is. So if you don't mind, we can kind of shift the topic here back to egalitarianism, kind of what it is, and stop me if I'm wrong here, but egalitarianism, it's kind of the view that all humans should be equal, not only in how they're viewed by other people or how they're treated by other people, basically that we all have the same rights as everyone else, but that it takes it a step further and that all humans should have equal outcomes in their lives. Am I wrong in saying that? You know, Thurman kind of brought up this topic earlier, or David or Thurman, do you guys kind of see anything wrong with the definition there?
No, just egalitarian. I would define it as just equality on the basis of gender, economically, politically, all that blah blah blah. So, I mean, I thought your definition was pretty good.
David, is there anything wrong with that definition? Am I incorrect?
Remind me again what it was.
So, egalitarianism, basically the belief that equality is the main virtue to strive for, wherein not only is everyone does everyone enjoy the same rights to life and property, but everyone also, society should strive for them to all have equal outcomes as well.
Yeah, I mean, in as much as that's possible, I think that's the ideal, and obviously it's getting there that's the tricky part.
Yeah, I tend to agree that it's kind of blurry on how you would necessarily achieve that. So where it comes down to, where libertarians would say, they would kind of latch on to a beginning of this and say, yeah, we agree with you in the sense that everyone should enjoy the right to life and property. So a libertarian would say, you know, your rights are negative rights. Your right to property is your right not to be stolen from, or your right to life is your right not to be killed. So where it kind of gets muddied is, how is it even possible to create a society in which equal outcomes are achieved? What would have to happen?
I think the education system would be in need of massive overhauls.
Amen to that.
I don't know. What's that?
I said amen to that. I can second that.
Yeah, and so, you know, I often hear people say this, you know, teach a man to fish, don't give him a fish. Well, right, but what I'm in favor of is expanding the education system, making sure that, you know, there's a huge problem with children in low-income areas falling drastically behind in our inner cities, and a lot of that is leftover structural inequality. So, like, I had a fortunate background. The family I was born into was well off. I, you know, was educated in private schools, and so I think making sure that everybody has decent access to a good start is vital.
So, I think we can agree. People need to be educated, or people should to seek out education to better oneself is a good thing. But where I kind of see the roads diverging here is that a libertarian would say the market is the best way to solve this problem. For instance, I too see a huge problem with public schooling, especially when you can go on YouTube in high school in less than the time it takes for you to be in high school. So a libertarian here would say, you know, I come from the anarchist section, but there's the minarchist argument that if you're going to implement public schools, at least give people vouchers and choose where they spend their money to kind of, if you're going to have public education, kind of put it in, introduce some kind of market principle into it. Where would you stand with that kind of thing?
I guess I don't necessarily think the free market is the best way to go when it comes to education. I think it is it benefits our society to have a well-educated citizenry, and that makes us all safer. It makes us all, you know, more qualified for the shift in jobs that's coming up. I think that, you know, if the private sector were capable of doing it, I just don't believe that's possible. I don't think that it's, I think it's too large a project for a private sector to take on.
Well, the private sector is capable of doing it, hence why they're, most kids in private school out-test getting better schools than those kids in public schools.
Well, right, but it's making that private schooling accessible. And when money plays a factor, I mean, just look at the way private for-profit colleges run compared to, you know, four-year institutions. So a master's degree from, you know, DeVry doesn't mean as much as a bachelor's from Michigan. And another problem with those schools is, you know, I guess that college is kind of a different entity from primary education. So.
Okay, I'm going to have to, when it comes to, I've recently had somebody bring that up is when they say, just look at the way, you know, of course, when you get a degree from a public school, that it means more. And that's just simply from the fact that, of course, if you bring a diploma from a public school, you know, if you have public schools regulated by, say, governments and all these things, of course it's going to mean more. If you go to a company that's regulated from the government, of course it's going to mean more. So that just makes sense with the system we have now. So and if we had a free market, of course that would change. So
I should back up a little on the private for-profit colleges. The bigger problem with those is actually that they have spent so much of their resources in recruiting, and they make it extremely easy for people to walk in the door and get loans that they probably shouldn't be getting. And what happens then is you have incredibly high default rates, you have incredibly high like failure rates when it comes to these schools, because they're more interested in getting people in the door, showing them the loan they can find for them, regardless of whether this person is actually prepared or not. And so you have, you know, you have shareholders on the board of this college whose motive is profit and not student success. And the reason they get away with a lot of that is because they are private and they're not, you know, as subject to the regulations that public schools are.
I want to jump in here. When we're talking about the free market in education, I would actually argue that private schools today, the way the system's set up, you know, lower income kids don't have access to the quote unquote better schooling. And I would point out that precisely the reason is that they've been crowded out. The middle class market has kind of been, you know, you have this super cheap and basically quote unquote free option with the government, where if you are, you know, good students are always going to be good students no matter where they go. But for the lower income kids who weren't raised in a certain community, they're kind of getting the short end of the stick. But because the government kind of crowds out a huge portion of the market, it leaves the kids who want a better schooling or the families that want to pay for it. They're driven into the hands of people who are able to raise their prices through, you know, things like licensing or curriculum standards you have to follow, or just getting started and getting in the door. It kind of seems like to me the government's set up a barrier to the thrifty education centers that would arrive in the free market. And then the other thing, I actually did a research project on student loans for one of my speech classes. And I think student loans are a huge problem in college, and especially with the private colleges, but not only with the private colleges, I think with the public colleges too. And from my findings in the research, it kind of came to starting in the 1980s at the end of Carter's administration through Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush second, the government's involvement in student loans, basically guaranteeing lenders against default, has made them and the amount of people they're giving loans to. So, and you're right, you know, they just show them the loan program that works for them to get them in the door so they can pocket the money, which is true. You're kind of right there. But it's kind of the government's kind of blown up a bubble by expanding credit and making it easier to obtain credit. So then when you have a lot more kids with money in their hands, it kind of bids up the price for everyone else. And students who normally used to say, because, you know, we all heard it from our grandparents, oh, I used to work my way through college. Well, you can't really do that because the amount of credit money that's being funneled into higher education through the expansion of credit is kind of a big deal. And there are kids who can't pay it back, but it doesn't matter to the banks and the lenders, because ultimately the kids aren't paying them. When they know some kids will, because they'll get out of college, they'll get a good degree, and that'll offset one thing. But the way the math works out, the government will reimburse them in case the student defaults anyway. So it lowers the risk and increases the supply of money from the economic standpoint of it. So the way I look at it is there's kind of no reason to expect that a free market wouldn't solve the problem when what we see with private schooling now is kind of a it's not even a free market if you want to say that. They're kind of piggybacking off of the crowding out that the government does, and it leaves them to pick up the scraps of the wealthy people who have nowhere else to go.
And also, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. That's fine.
And I also think, you know, not even just the money situation, which I know is a big argument that is going around, because of course that's important, especially with free markets. But I think one of our larger issues is not even just the money, because of course that's the first step of getting into the door is important, but also the fact of we're all so focused on money that we're not focused on the actual education. And at this point, when we're so focused on the money, we're not realizing the fact that our education system is getting all sorts of, like, just the education people are getting is terrible. So it doesn't matter how much money you're putting into a private or public school. Our curriculum is starting to fall apart at this point. So I'm thinking, who cares how much money you put into any of this right now? Our education system is just kind of, it's not getting anybody anywhere. Like, why aren't we paying a little bit more attention to that? And with all this government-regulated stuff we got going on now, it doesn't look like any of the expanding of the government is doing anything with our education system. So I'm not sure how much I'm putting any trust in that at this point. Like, aren't they supposed to be fixing that anywhere? And why can't the free market be given a chance for people who want to educate these kids? If there are people who are passionate about there's curriculums online, like everywhere in libertarian community, and actually I've seen curriculums that aren't even libertarian that are willing to put stuff out there and educate people and actually put the time in that have passion for these things. So it's not like if suddenly the government or a governing body decided, you know what, fine, we're just not going to do it, and somebody won't do it free market style, there wouldn't be people with the passion that wouldn't step up to do it. So it's not like we wouldn't just run out of people because there isn't a governing body in the government to actually do it. There are people who have a passion for this sort of thing that we need to be encouraging to do this.
Yeah, I think we got to treat this kind of, you know, almost as a product. You know, how do we give the best amount of education to the most amount of people? And do you guys think it's reasonable that all education throughout the whole country can be the same?
No, it shouldn't be.
I think people should be allowed to buy whatever product, you know, suits them. Because and when you look at the education now, kids are in 12 years of public school when they really don't need to be in school for that long. If a kid who really wants to apply, and there are ways a kid really wants to apply himself now, he can graduate early and do this and that. But the kind of curriculum is just kind of it seems like it's kind of bloated to just keep the administrative income kind of coming in, because we know that teachers are teaching tests and they're teaching standardized tests so the kids can get the test scores so that their school can get more funding. Whereas the free market solution would be let the market and the schools actually compete with each other to give each other the best product and compete for the best teachers, which we see in every single other facet of the economy. When the free market is allowed to work, it drives prices down and drives the quality up. So I'm not sure why for this special instance the market would not be a solution.
And I also want to point out, if we're talking about egalitarianism, are we talking about it equality for everything, for everyone across the board, including the education everybody would get?
Yes, right?
Yeah. So then the egalitarian argument would be everyone should have the exact same education.
Right.
Yeah, and obviously that so, like, if you're talking about giving the exact same education to everyone, a lot of it ties into, so you said, like, a good student's going to do well no matter where they are. In some instances, that's true. In a lot of instances, though, the parents' quality of life and the parents' income has a huge effect on the success, you know, on the outcomes of their child's education. So part of the problem, and part of the reason I guess egalitarianism seems really important to me, is that leveling the playing field economically to the point where, there's been a lot of studies done on the way your brain works under scarcity. So, you know, you've got your kid in school, right? And that kid's parents are poor. They're either working two jobs, they're coming home with lack of sleep, or stressed about bills. They're spending their whole lives in that. So, like, if you're well off and you have a lot of money and you get a flat tire or you get in an accident with your car, no big deal. Money's going to fix that problem. If you are poor, that's like a month or longer worth of extra stress on top of what you are already thinking about. So there's all this extra consuming of your emotional and mental energy when you're poor, and it makes it harder to nurture your children. It makes it harder for the children to focus when their parents are constantly stressed and possibly fighting more often. You know, we know money is the biggest driver behind divorce, so that's another reason a lot of these communities are in disarray. You also have a much higher incarceration rate among people who live in poor communities. It's not that these people are worse people, it's that poverty forces you to make decisions that you wouldn't otherwise normally make. For instance, short-term versus long-term reward thinking. Under stress and under the effects of scarcity, basically, you are more likely to go for the short-term reward. You're less likely to put off any kind of pleasurable experience because so much of your life is consumed with a stressful input. And so when you release your mind from that, when you are free to, like, look at a decision you might make, like, what do I eat for dinner? Do I eat, you know, the lousy cheap fast food, or do I go out and buy groceries because I know that long-term that'll make me healthy, it'll make me feel better? Your brain just doesn't have the energy to process all of that. So that's another reason I think egalitarianism is important, and it does tie back into the education system as well. So you have to address all of these issues kind of at once, and that's why it is such a big problem, or it is such a big project. But it all kind of ties into each other.
Okay, I want to jump in. So I do agree that definitely income and education or just all that stuff. I definitely agree with everything you just said. But my only problem with egalitarianism and education, pedagogy, you know, the method and practice of teaching, it's different. And different places in the nation as well as in the world want to teach different things because of whether jobs that are available in different areas of the nation, whatever have you. I just think, you know, there's different methods and practices. Some teachers are way better at teaching specific things than others. And I think that those teachers should get paid, you know, whatever their fair wage, honestly, you know, whatever that be. I'll just leave it at that. But I don't think that. And I have to say, you know, I recently read Egalitarianism, A Revolt Against Nature, and it was such
That's
a good
reading.
I would definitely recommend that. And it really changed my views on egalitarianism and what it really is, or what most people think. I don't necessarily agree that we all should have the same exact education, or that it, you know, should all be paid for by the government, you know, whatever have you. But there definitely is a problem with income, for sure. I just don't think that egalitarianism is a good solution for it.
I think where he's coming from is that it definitely affects the poor, and it affects the poor's ability, you know, to make short-term versus long-term decisions. But I just kind of want to ask David, you know, what is your definition of poverty? What is poverty?
Yeah, I mean, and that's obviously, it's kind of like, you know, asking. I guess I don't know a good metaphor for that. It's a little tricky to nail down, obviously. So I guess my definition would be basic necessities met, the ability to, I don't know. It's a hard thing to define, obviously.
How about a household income annually of $30,000?
A household income? I mean,
For a family of four, I guess. You know.
Would you? Are you asking? Does he consider that poverty?
Yeah. Could we agree that maybe that would be poverty?
Or it depends where you live.
Oh yeah, you got me there.
I mean, you would have to start like figuring out. I mean, Las Vegas as compared to, I don't know, if you pick another like city somewhere else. Las Vegas is a different size than other places in Nevada.
If you go to California or New York and 30K, you're like on the street.
Yeah, So I grew up in poverty. I'm from California. I mean, that was my household income. So that's why I threw that out there.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely. So I live in Michigan. I make around 30 a year, and I could not support a family of four on that. Not, I mean, I could, but just I can't even imagine that, honestly. You know, another thing that's been interesting working in insurance is, I guess I don't know if this is a tangent or not, but so I do quotes all day. So one of the things that the insurance industry changed recently was now they'll run your credit when they go to determine your rate. And they used to not do that. But with so much of the country, you know, in default on student loans and just having recovered from kind of a major recession that we're still sort of pulling out of. And so what I'll do is I'll talk to a woman in her 50s who's, you know, she and her husband, you know, have lived well for many years, and they've never had any lapses in insurance. They've got a really good credit score. They've got, you know, high limits on their policies and stuff like that. They get multi-car and multi-vehicle and multi-policy discounts. And, you know, you've got a 54-year-old woman paying $60 a month for full coverage on her 2015 vehicle. And then when I go to talk to a woman who lives, you know, in the inner city, she's got three or four kids. She's had, you know, I don't know, either a divorce or her husband's incarcerated or not in the picture, or he is working and they're just barely getting by, but they've had money issues. So they've had lapses in coverage. They've had, you know, credit hits. Maybe they're even in default on student loans. I've even seen like motor vehicle reports get affected by tickets they can't afford to pay because they're not adjusted to your income. And so these people end up paying $285 a month for liability coverage. And it just makes it like, it's easier to save money when you're paying a fraction, you know, a sixth, a ninth of what someone else is paying. And they make a third or quarter of your income. So there are a lot of other factors at work that contribute to poverty and to keeping people in it. They otherwise might have climbed out of it.
Are any of these like the older people in their 50s? Did any of those people attend college?
What's that?
Any of the people that are, you know, paying less that are in their 50s that you're doing the quotes for, did they go to college?
You know, honestly, because I'm in Michigan, and a lot of mid-Michigan is kind of like rural and factory and farm areas. So I talk to a lot of people who are doing very well for themselves, and they've got tons of vehicles. They've got a nice house. They didn't go to high school. The majority of them didn't go to college. Sorry. They have high school diplomas.
Okay.
So no, kind of been all over the place.
So I guess the choice of paying for college is killing us in this generation.
It is, and it's not really a choice either, because you used to be able to come out of high school and get a job, and, you know, a couple of years later you had a house and you could support a family of three. Now that's not an option. You have to go to college. It's not really a choice. If you want to have a happy life and a successful life, and you're basically still a kid when you're 18. I was an idiot until I was like, until yesterday, and I'm probably still an idiot. So like, these kids are taking on this massive debt, and that, the size of the debt they've needed has grown, and, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of factors at play.
With that being said, we see public school, high school being free. Do you think making college free would, you know, make that degree more valuable?
I guess I don't know if it would make it more valuable. I think it would result in a better informed citizenry, a population that's more well-equipped to, like, move into a digital age where less and less will need manual labor, and we'll need well-educated workers and people who are qualified to, you know, have a thought and vote. So it benefits us all as a society. I mean, when you have when you pull people out of it, it raises our standards, it reduces crime. You know, there are a lot of benefits.
And I just had one question. People might try to like yell at me if I say this, but college actually technically still is a choice. Now, who has made it mandatory? Now, I know I work IT, so trying to walk into an office to get a job like mine, they're going to be like, where the heck is your diploma? But it still is a choice. I do have friends who have jobs. I have a friend who works for the post office, started working for the post office outside of high school, and makes more than me as an IT person. So there are job opportunities for people without diplomas. It's just harder to get, obviously. It's possible to do, but all that to say, who made it the choice that we have to go to college to do it? And I enjoy going to college. And as people probably have listened to this podcast, as you guys know, I love to read the hell out of books, man. I'm all about educating at all times. You know, I don't feel like going back to college, definitely. But in everybody's opinion, who made it that we have to go to college? Why did this become something in our generation that we just have to go to college?
I think it was a luxury the baby boomer generation really got to experience, right? As Dave said, you know, back then you could get a job right out of high school and probably even afford for your kid to go to high school, or I mean to college, for cheap. And I think that was a luxury that they got to live, and it kind of just because of the, you know, the post-war economic boom, I think that had a huge contribution to, you know, the higher education that, you know, our parents really got to experience.
I want to build on what Tim said there about the luxury that they used to be able to afford. See, the problem with trying to define poverty is that David was right. You know, it does depend on where you live. I'm in Oklahoma. It's a super cheap cost of living. It's amazing. But another reason is that the cost of actually living and having your basic necessities covered has declined since the Industrial Revolution. So your ability to get to earn a meal costs you what at the minimum wage now $7.25. You can have a meal that'll cover your basic necessities by only working 1 hour. It basically only takes you 1 hour to acquire the resources necessary to exchange for food. Another reason I do think that the poor are getting poorer, and I think income inequality is a thing in this country. But I think when we say that the free market's not the one to solve it, we're basically ignoring all the other factors that government plays in the role of keeping people poor, of inflating the currency and dwindling away their savings. You know, you can't save because the cost of everything you buy goes up every single year. And on top of that, there's an incentive trap, like a lot of welfare programs are. I just turned down the opportunity to go to keep going to college for free. It was a welfare program. I'm personally opposed to that. So I turned it down. When you look at it, even with Pell Grants. So basically what a Pell Grant is if you're a student, full-time student, you get $5,500 per semester to go to school, $55 or split over two semesters to go to school. I forget which one it is. But the more you work outside of school, that the money that you're eligible for to receive in the Pell Grant dwindles. So here's the deal. You can have $5,500 going to school to pay for your fees and everything, or you can try to work and get and basically try to earn your way through school and maybe earn $7,000 on a part-time job outside of the curriculum. Basically, what you've done is you've done all that work. You've gone to school and put a lot of stress on yourself for only a $1,500 benefit. So there's the incentive trap there of basically guaranteeing people something for nothing when trying to have something for a little bit more costs a lot of time and effort. And frankly, I can see why people don't make the choice to do it.
Yeah. I mean, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just saying, yeah.
yeah. And it's, you know, it's a valid point too about college and its true necessity. So I don't have a college degree. I never did finish one. I kind of jumped around. I love school. I'm a constant learner. But I couldn't, I don't know, for whatever reason, I didn't make it work. But so I have a decent job. I do. I make, you know, 30 plus a year. I probably make more than that now. But I'm extremely fortunate, though. I had a good background. I was naturally intelligent. I had a father who was a doctor and a mother who was a nurse who educated me and taught me in the home a lot. They were also well off. And so I whiffed my way through tons of chances and pissed away tons of time and money. But my advantages to start with were so great that I'm able to, you know, parlay that into a job where I can actually support myself. Most people are not as fortunate as I am. So the cost of college being so prohibitive is a big problem. And there are a lot of ways to address that. I think a good one that's come up recently is these MOOCs, these online colleges, where you can essentially audit Ivy level colleges. You know, I think Stanford's Philosophy 101 had like, you know, 90,000 registries this semester, just auditing it. And you can go through and take those programs and educate yourself. And they'll give you a certificate at the end that says, you know, you audited this, but you take it to a company now. And a lot of these companies are looking at it like, well, in front of me stands a well-put-together, well-educated person who just did Stanford-level work, and they didn't pay for it. So, like, what do I care if they paid for it or not? So, yeah, there are a lot of ways to address it that don't necessarily mean, like, shelling out a ton of money for free college for everyone.
So is that – that kind of sounds like a free market solution to me.
Yep.
Yeah, it is. And, I'm not against the free market solution. So there – I mean, there's a branch of libertarianism called libertarian socialism, and, you know – I'm not for the sort of government takeover of industry. I'm completely in favor of a lot of free market solutions in businesses, and I just think the regulations need to play a large role. And I think we agree on that too. I think we just disagree on the kind of the scope.
Well, egalitarianism, the only way it would happen is through the government.
I guess I don't know. It hasn't been done yet.
basically, what he's saying is it could be Stanford is through government actively enforcing Stanford. So he read Thurman read Egalitarianism as a Resistance Against Nature, and I did too.
I did too. It was good.
And Kim did. The reason that it the author Rothbard kind of puts it as a revolt against nature is that it's an ideal that can never really be achieved, because in order to achieve it, you'd have to depreciate everyone's standard of living so much for a goal that could never be attained. So basically what he says the problem with the conservatives is the conservatives kind of concede the ethical aspect of egalitarianism and socialism to agree to the left, and but then the conservatives will try to agree on the practicality of it. And Rothbard says, you know, that's kind of a mistake, because it's like saying that humans wishing that we could flap our wings and fly is ethically, it sounds kind of nice, but in practice it could never work. And he kind of says that in order for this to even be a theory worth accepting or conceding a high ground to, it has to be something that can work. So it's basically saying, if the theory is wrong, any aspect of it is also wrong. But where I kind of want to put a spin on this in another way, not try to, you know, put down egalitarianism, not necessarily just industrialization, but the free market competition and all these other things have raised everyone's standard of living, especially the poor, to such a high degree that get involved with that and to try to tear it down and undo the incentive structure and the lattice work of the market that is shown able to solve complicated problems peacefully is kind of to pursue an idea that you will never reach the end of, and you'll destroy yourself before you get there.
Go ahead. And also the fact, like, you know, it's just not necessarily the fact that egalitarianism is a bad thing at all, because I think equality is a good thing to strive for. But what I think is the way that it's trying to be put into practice is being done in error, because I think it's more like the way it's being pushed into the world today seems more like something where it's more of an envy of what other people have. And so they're kind of using that to get supposed equality for certain groups of people. So it seems more like a group egalitarianism as opposed to an equality for everyone is what I'm starting to see around here. And of course I would like to see equality. Everybody should have the right to be able to, you know, of course, you know, have rights to property, have, you know, rights to be left alone, be able to progress and succeed without being impeded by anybody, without being held down or held back by anybody. But it seems like what people are looking for is equality for certain groups. So I think we're in a season of group egalitarianism, if you even get what I'm... Is anybody else seeing that, or am I just totally crazy?
Yeah, so you're essentially saying that we're being divided into a group of haves versus the have-nots.
Yeah.
Could I read a quote from the book, Egalitarianism?
I think David wanted to say something first, but then we'll
go ahead.
Okay. No, go ahead, David.
Okay. This is from page 8. It says, mankind is uniquely characterized by a high degree of variety, diversity, and differentiation. In short, inequality. An egalitarianism society can only hope to achieve its goals by totalitarian methods of coercion. Since egalitarians begin with the a priori axiom that all people, and hence all groups of peoples, are uniform and equal, it then follows for them that any and all group differences in status, prestige, or authority in society must be the result of unjust oppression and irrational discrimination.
End quote.
Yeah, end quote. Excuse me. Okay. So when I first read that, it really shot down my entire viewpoint of egalitarianism. And it made me think, okay, maybe I guess I'm thinking – the equality I was thinking of is completely different than what egalitarianism is or what everybody says. What were you just talking about? Like, with, you know, again, going back to education, I just I don't see how things could be equal without, as he's saying, oppression, you know, oppression, and, you know, without the government setting the price for college or for whatever have you. And I don't think it should be that way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously, up until now, the free market has been a huge driver of, you know, advances in standard of living. Of course, it has. And science and medicine and technology have also played a huge role in that, and I think they will continue to play an even bigger role. We are kind of heading towards a point where technology is going to make it possible for eat everyone on the planet, like, relatively soon. I mean,
completely agree. Completely. Hell yeah.
You know, vertical towers filled with hydroponic crop growing machines that recirculate all the water. It's all powered by solar energy. I mean, this is why investments in renewables are important. Not because, we'll probably figure out climate change. But another reason, like, that these, we've needed expanded roles for government and expanded regulations is because, like I said, we have almost 7 billion people on the planet now. Things are different. There isn't just limitless space for everyone to spread out and take what they need and not mess with anybody else. Our resources are all interconnected now. You know, there are plenty of good reasons to do this, and I think technology will kind of address a lot of the issues in terms of the mechanical aspects of how do we actually get to egalitarianism. Because obviously, yeah, if you're trying to force it when it's just not, like, kind of doable, then there's bound to be a lot of oppression, and you want to minimize that. So
That reminds me of the, you know, kind of what Karl Marx said when he, you know, as far as, you know, he believed that there was this natural progression of history, and one of the instances that he believed that time was in was the capitalist side, and of course, Marx could never have imagined what capitalism turned the world into. But from a Marxist perspective, he kind of goes on what you said, David, that that you can't just force egalitarianism. It has to come naturally on its own, basically through capitalism. But the little caveat that he threw in there is that egalitarianism has to come at a time where humanity has basically reached its peak and it's ready for it. And the way to get there is basically unregulated and unhampered capitalism. So even from the Marxist perspective, it's kind of hard to see a role in government and hampering capitalism when getting rid of capitalism ultimately has to be a peaceful thing. And you kind of basically the Marxist even says you have to let it have its due.
Yeah, no, I agree too. And yeah, timing is obviously crucial. Well, part of the problem though is I'm afraid we won't reach that point before our resources are gutted, before, you know, corporations that are allowed to go unregulated, basically make this place uninhabitable and create, you know, massive shortages, massive migrations of humans. I mean, that's what we're seeing now. Like, the massive human migration that's going on right now is just totally in response to the fact that we're overcrowded, we're misusing resources. But I think it's important for us to adapt our government.
So correct me if I'm wrong, that kind of is Thomas Malthus' philosophy that, you know, the world is getting so overcrowded that there's not going to be enough resources. And basically, because of that, there's the need. Now, Malthus was kind of extreme. He kind of took it to the point where, correct me if I'm wrong, that he kind of said, you know, this is a bad thing. We need to get rid of those people. I forget if that's him or that's Machiavelli or someone else. But Malthus was basically wrong when he thought that the world would run out of resources by a certain time period, because what he could not have foreseen and what he didn't foresee was the creative power of the market to increase production and capacity of the world to such a degree where it's not that the world is expanding and resources can't expand with it. It's kind of the other way around. It's kind of that production has expanded and humanity has expanded along with it. So I agree with you that science and technology has given us this incredible standard of living and our ability to produce things. You know, you said the high-rise farms and recycling water. But it's really that technology is kind of, it's driven by human action. And where Marx was kind of wrong is that, you know, history doesn't just follow a predictable pattern of things that come out. Because if that was true, then the Roman civilization would have led directly into industrialization and the Middle Ages would have never happened, like the Dark Ages, when Europe fell into kind of a trap. You know, history doesn't just progress in a more or less, what's the word I'm looking for?
Linear.
In a linear way. It's not always an improvement. You know, people do go backwards, but it takes human action to bring these things about, and it takes human action to bring about technology. And kind of the historical record has kind of shown that when governments get in the way of markets to do their thing, it hampers the speed and development. And just another point, because, you know, we know corporations dump and they pollute and they do all this stuff. But, you know, from a libertarian perspective, we don't agree with that either, because, you know, property rights are a thing. And if you pollute in someone else's land, you know, that's not good. It's against the NAP. But kind of where the government has stepped in, they kind of done away with the common law way of looking at this and said, well, you can produce an acceptable amount. And as long as it doesn't go over this amount, because the government scientists have decided that this amount is too bad, you know, up to a certain number, it's okay, but then it just becomes too bad. And it always ends up being that these corporations are writing or paying and lobbying for these acceptable amounts to change and this and that. So it just kind of seems to me that I think libertarians also agree with equality. Basically, everyone can enjoy the right to life and property at the same time. But the egalitarian change in that kind of seems to be, you know, we should all agree or enjoy our life, our rights to life and property. Unless you have more than I do, then my right to property to have the same as you overpowers your right to property. Am I wrong there? Am I being too harsh? Or
I think the focus a lot of times when you talk about leveling the playing field is chopping off the tallest heads of you know, tallest blades of grass, chopping off the, you know, the outliers. And it's less about limiting the ceiling and more about raising the floor, because, you know, it's possible now like never before to, like, as a child, you interact with people from around the world. So you see kids growing up in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa and third world countries. You interact with them and you look into their faces like never before. And you start to realize that, like, we all basically kind of start off wanting the same things. We need, you know, security, compassion, you know, connection, a sense of purpose. But along the way, different influences twist our ability to achieve this. And with the expansion of population, you've got overcrowding and people just being packed into areas where they wouldn't normally be if this was, you know, 150 years ago, where everyone's kind of spread out. Access to resources was, you know, largely what you could get. Sorry, I'm losing my train of thought again.
So can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you think that the unjust or the crazy amount of distribution that has taken place that kind of, you know, drives some people towards egalitarianism or this extreme want for equality, you don't necessarily understand it? Do you think that the distribution of resources with respect to population being what it is and the negatives that come with that, do you think that's a result of the market, or do you think that's the result of government getting in the way?
I think we largely have had relatively unregulated markets. You haven't had the technology to kind of monitor, like, you know, Volkswagen taking advantage of CO2 emission standards. You didn't have that back in the day. So yeah, I think a lot of it does come from the free market and the government's ability to regulate it. We've also got incredible technology that allows us to compile data and understand the way business practices impact economies and the people and the environment around them in ways that were never before possible. So you basically kind of had to take a hands-off approach, because without, you know, data and without evidence to back it up, it did feel too much like infringement on the corporation's right to, you know, to make a profit and to be a successful business. But now, like, now it's kind of changed that a little bit.
You're kind of saying that we exist in a very unregulated market today.
Yeah, I mean, largely we have until now. I don't think the market has been that regulated until now.
When is now? Like, when did the until now start?
Well, I guess I'm saying the I don't know. It's a good question. I think largely what you've, I think, so you were right in criticizing Marx for thinking that society progresses linearly. There is a lot of, like, two steps forward, one step back. But, I mean, for the most part, you start at year zero and move towards now. You are seeing society increasingly just do nothing but improve. So I think that society does generally move towards better ideas triumphing over bad ones. And yeah, capitalism has served us extremely well until now. Nobody's suggesting doing away with it entirely, but now that we recognize what people will do when profit's their only motive, you know, we're able to get a better picture of what that actually does to the environment. Not an environment being like people, economies. You know. Yeah.
So my question for everyone here is: do we think that humanity will prosper in a truly free market, no regulation? Do we think that the climate change crisis will increase or decrease?
David, you can go first.
I feel like I'm talking too much, honestly.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to answer Thurman's question second, but I'm looking here at the total pages in the Code of Federal Regulations, 1975, there's about 65,000 pages of regulations, and the graph ends at 2011. I'm sure there's more now. The graph ends at about 180,000 pages of federal regulations. So it seems to me that this increasing problem, increasing distortions in the market and the income inequality, and, you know, bankers making insane salaries while poor people see the inflation tax hit them every year, it seems to me that the lack of regulation doesn't exist. And then on the other hand, I do believe that the market is the best way to solve the climate change debate. Basically because what we see now, and I think David would agree, oil companies get insane amount of subsidies, which keep other kinds of energy companies out of the market. Now Bernie Sanders will come out and say, well, we need to end those oil subsidies. And I think we all here agree. But then Bernie Sanders will also turn around and say, well, then we should give it to these other energy companies. Which I don't necessarily agree with. You know, maybe fossil fuels at this point in time are the most efficient way, and
they're not anymore.
What the climate change models didn't predict was our ability to increase efficiency out of these fossil fuels. So basically, we can get more out of the fossil fuels than we could ever before. And I mean, when you look at everything, you know, do corporations pollute the worst? Or if you're just getting down to pollution, government entities, especially the United States Department of the Defense, is history's largest polluter. Namely, I'm going to look it up real fast, how many atomic bombs they dropped in the Pacific Ocean. I can't find a corporation that's, you know, I couldn't think of another nuclear disaster that works for the environment other than, you know, the Fukushima meltdown.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about the way our government has spent money on the military and what we've spent it on, I mean, we're on the same side there.
Yeah, pretty much.
It seems to be, though, but you also get, you know, you have China and their hyper-managed economy. Now, they've gotten a little bit better with their special economic zones allowing freedom. But you look in places like Shanghai where the smog is so bad now that they can't even go outside. Or, you know, you look at Russia, how basically they didn't necessarily destroy their environment, but their intense control over prices and all these other things led to food shortages and just people dying all over the place. So, it kind of seems to me that to pin climate change or its as yet unrealized negative effects on corporations, it kind of seems like a red herring, when it seems to me like corporations are utilizing, you know, if you look at the government like a car, right? So corporations are using these cars to give them excuses to pollute, reasons to pollute, acceptable amounts to pollute, and to keep other kinds of competing industries out of the market. Whereas if you kind of let that go, you kind of let the market devour itself. So maybe in the near term, maybe fossil fuels and oil, because everything you touch came from oil. Anything with plastic in it came from oil. In order to really use the government to move towards a climate solution, would you know, Bernie Sanders thinks it would climate change eventually is going to hurt the poor. But yet, it's kind of like how the Republicans think that we need to fight these people who want to take away our freedoms by taking away our freedoms. The answer to subsidize alternative energy sources to such the degree to create economic growth would, so that it doesn't hurt the poor, would ultimately hurt the poor because it would lower everyone's standard of living just to funnel resources into a massive project on such a scale.
Okay, let me jump in there. Because I think we should really, the real big problem is we need to end all subsidized. I don't know if anybody's aware right now, but just today, Max Planck Institute in Germany, they turned on a Stellinator. It's a nuclear reactor. So we're actually fusing, or they're attempting to fuse like actual atoms together. So that's something that just came out. It's totally new. If we had one of those in America, it could power all of America for millions of years.
And
depending on, oh, I'm sorry.
I said, and if it came to America, who do you think will get a hold of that?
So that's what I'm saying. That's what I was going to jump on. You know, I think we just really need to get rid of the government because, you know, so I've been doing, I read that, or I watched this Mises Institute boot camp, and there are 6 episodes. I don't think, you know, businesses, corporations, you know, thinking about entrepreneurs acting rationally, you know, especially with so much climate change or so much information about climate change gotten out to the public. I think entrepreneurs rationally thinking are going to try and move to corporations and businesses who are looking and who are looking away from fossil fuels, you know, getting into electricity, nuclear fusion, and all other things that are going to be a lot safer for the environment. So I personally think in a free market, I think we would eventually get there, and it's happening relatively fast. It used to be the case to where fossil fuels were the most efficient to convert energy, but that's certainly not the case now at all.
I want to jump in real fast again before we let, you know, someone else take over. But when I think about, you know, the whole idea of solving climate change and using the government to do it, kind of seems to me that they can't do it. There's no way they can figure out what benefits human lives to the greatest extent, because it's just one person with one idea kind of having all their underlings following them, or a group of people with ideas. And you're not really setting it to a democratic process. Now, even if 51% of the people or 70% of the people vote them in, you're still not able to create or find or even recognize it when you see it, the technology of tomorrow, the same way an entrepreneur or a consumer market can. Basically, one of the biggest things I'm looking at here is, you know, a lot of times the government is credited with the internet. You say, oh, look, the internet you have today, well, the government did it. Well, there was a time when the government saw no use for the internet and they kind of left it for dead, and it was up to private companies to pick it up and revitalize this whole thing. It's where we can see kids in other nations and look at them face to face and do all these wonderful things, which really, I think we're on the cusp of another industrial revolution, and that's the digital revolution, and it's just getting started.
And the detail, oh, sorry, Durbin. I just had to explain. Sorry, Thurman. It's a good thing I could see your face. But I just want to expand on what Christian said, because we were like on the same wavelength there, Christian, me, you. But that's what I was, my case for a free market is the fact that it's like, I'm not trying to like be, you know, what it is that with a free market is just the people know what the people need. It's like me trying to tell any of you guys what your city and what your state needs, like, you know, or are you trying to tell me what, you know, Las Vegas needs? Like when, you know, I was telling you about, you know, everybody's like, you know, where's the best, you know, we're talking about before the show, where's the best brothel in Las Vegas? And I was like, what are you talking about? I can't walk anywhere and find one in Las Vegas. You're going to have to go out to the outskirts. You know, nobody knows what exactly what's my like city needs unless they're here. It's the same thing with the free market. You know, it's just, I know what my people here want. You know, I know what the market is here, and that's pretty much what a free market is. And when you try to have like one person come in and say, okay, this is what the people will have, and this is what we're going to do, and everybody, this is just what it's going to be. But, you know, the things are different around in these areas, and that, and a free market should be able to be like allowed to just say, hey, this is what we, you know, this is just what we need. And markets just should be able to do that, be able to give their consumers what they know they need and what they, you know, that's just what a free market needs to do. And when everybody says it needs to be regulated, and it just seems like when everybody talks about regulating things, they're looking at negatives. And that's why they say that things need to be regulated. Like, you know, everybody's a bunch of lemmings running around into walls or something like that. You know, the people are going to see if there's bad products. You know, I'm going to say Susie Q over there is poisoning the Cheerios and crap. Don't go to her store. Go to this person's store. You know, the market regulates itself, and you know, all these things, all these like things that everybody points out about free markets, the people know what the people need, and free markets should be able to do that. You know, they regulate themselves, things flow. That's how business is. And when people are so scared of free markets, you have to think about it. Free markets existed before everything else existed. And when people try to say, you know, they try to say, well, you know, there was a reason why there still aren't free markets. The reason that there aren't free markets is probably because somebody was like, hey, you know, we should start regulating this because, you know, we can get some profits out of this sort of thing. We should do something like that and get some profits on this, you know? Free markets existed. And, you know, when people say free markets don't work, well, guess what? Free markets existed before we had what we have now.
Well, but then you also have things like you do have giant corporations. So I think there's too much faith placed in the ability of negative PR to regulate the market. It's all well and good to say that, like, yeah, the society is going to demand clean energy. Like, yes, of course we are. That's basically what we're all doing now. But companies like, you know, the oil and gas industry, I mean, some of them are being forward thinking, I guess, but they've mostly been dragged there kicking and screaming by reformists. And you've still got like the majority of that industry, you know, obscuring progress, you know, paying tons of money to lobbyists to have, you know, favorable legislation written that has no, you know, no steps towards renewables, towards, you know, helping the environment, helping reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. Like, we know that continuing our current course with our reliance on fossil fuels is totally unsustainable, and it's fine. There's not really much reason to worry. We're not going to do that, but it's not like, you know, the free market is just, sometimes you do interfere with that process because relying on people's, you know, sense that a company is bad. I mean, companies lie. That's the point. They cover that kind of stuff up.
But usually the people they send in to interfere and fix that are usually people that don't have any idea of what the situation is. So they send somebody in that doesn't really know what they're talking about to regulate it.
There's two things here that I think need to be addressed. The first thing is there's the concept of regulatory capture where regulators and people who work for these federal agencies, they write a law, and then 2 years later, you see them working for the company, or vice versa, you know, the company moving into it. And the other thing that I think, David, is kind of important to point out is that when you talk about these large corporations, you know, that don't answer to anyone, well, there's a specific reason that they don't answer to anyone. It's because the corporate structure is basically a shell game to keep liability out of the hands of acting individuals. So basically, you see these gigantic corporations that have such a huge sway. Well, that's because these people are able to pool their money and pay for it out of basically, if you or I polluted someone else's land, we're held liable for that. But when you get into the corporate structure and the way it's defended by the government, you know, it, this whole structure is propped up and sustained by government. It is the law where if, say, Exxon pollutes your land, you can't sue the person who dropped the oil on the land. You sue Exxon. And Exxon keeps safe individuals from their actions in a legal sense.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree.
So I think even from that standpoint, I think government has protected individuals from having to face their fears. And, you know, kind of whether it's a monopoly or whether it's a gigantic corporation, a corporate entity, you know, there's, I think we can agree there's a difference between a corporation becoming so gigantic because it you know, provides the best widgets to consumers. And there's another thing to say that the corporation becomes so gigantic because no matter what it does, the individuals who are making decisions don't act for it because the corporation's granted personhood legally. And that seems more like a legal issue than a free market.
Yeah, I mean, well, we completely agree that I'm sorry, I totally lost train of thought. Government has been a tool and a shield for abuse. I agree completely. There's been plenty of corruption. Nobody's in favor of that, though. Everybody wants to eliminate that, or at least from the side I'm sitting on, is in favor of transparency. Like, I'm as big a fan of Snowden as any of you guys. I think he's a hero. Mm-hmm. Nobody's for corporation being or government being used as like a cudgel to shut down industry and growth. It's about regulating the damage that, I mean, you've got, look at the telecom situation right now. You've got six companies controlling 90% of the market share. Like, these aren't just individual evil people acting. These are self-interested, you know, people who are accountable to shareholders, and look what they're doing. I mean,
well, what I would argue is that that is a product because of of influence on the government. I would say more often than less, all the things that we don't like about corporations are because of the government.
Especially telecom companies, especially, you know, you look at Cox or what's the other one, Comcast or these other companies, kind of in the net neutrality area. They're kind of granted special monopoly in their areas by the states they live in. You know, they don't face competition. So it's kind of hard to blame that on a free market. It seems like it's a regulated market for a specific purpose that causes these problems.
And also the fact that if you are in favor of some sort of governing body, where, of course, if you have any minarchist, you know, I'm still wavering on that line of minarchy versus anarchy. So you would think, if you want transparency, then I don't know if the answer should be bigger government. That just seems like, yeah, let's expand the problem. If you want the transparency, you might want to start smaller. So you have to start, like, you don't want to look in a bigger area to find the transparency. You want less area to look for the transparency, don't you?
Well, do we think the government is, you know, unable to be adapted? Of course, we need to adjust the size of it based on the scope of, like, I mean, our world is changing. I guess that's sort of that sounds like a platitude, but obviously we have to adjust the size. And yeah, I guess I don't see why that seems to be such a hang-up, because I think we agree that there needs to be transparency and that we need, you know, to prevent government overreach and we need to prevent corruption.
So would adjusting the government size, are we saying it should be bigger if we're talking about overreach and such things, to give crutches to corporations that don't act in the, you know, I don't believe in public good or anything. I'm a very hardcore individualist. Why give them another crutch? It seems to me that the best way to combat government overreach is to take away its reach in the first place. And it seems like its reach in the first place is what's allowed corporations to become so big and pollute and, you know, I mean, we can get into banking, too, if we want, because I know Occupy Wall Street. And I think there should have been people down on the streets in Wall Street, but it kind of seems like it was hijacked. And the message about, you know, what caused the market crash and who benefits from it. But to go on the climate change and all these other encompassing things, I just want to ask is, do you think the answer to solving the size and scope of government and to adapt it, do you think we need to make it larger or smaller?
Yeah, I guess I don't necessarily think it's about the size of it. I think it's about adapting the tool to fit the need. I don't care how big it is as long as it does what it's needed to do.
Well,
okay.
Oh.
So, did we hit on, is there anything else you wanted to talk about? We covered what, education, climate change.
I guess no, I'm not sure. Unless you guys had other topics to talk about, there's obviously plenty. I'd be happy to come back on sometime too if you'd like.
Oh yeah, we'd love to have you.
Cool. All right,
I like this guy. I like Dave.
I like you guys. You're cool.
I would recommend for our listeners and all of us who want to know more about climate change, Bill Nye, our childhood favorite, just came out with a new documentary just the beginning of November. It's called Bill Nye's Global Meltdown. I highly encourage everyone to go watch it. All the problems that we talk about, climate change, there's solutions. They're out there. We have this figured out. It's done. People just need to get on it.
I mean, I think climate change at this point is, I don't think you're going to get many people who argue that the Earth is not getting warmer. I think the debate really is it man-made, and how do we actually stop this? Is carbon emission the sole factor of what is heating up the Earth?
And is it really going to be is it a disaster that's appearing, it keeps advancing every 10 years, it's supposed to have destroyed us, and then it gets advanced another 10 years?
They said that back in the prehistoric times, the carbon rate in just the air was at least 60% higher than it is now. I could be wrong in that figure, but I think the real debate is, what's causing the world to get hotter, and how do we combat the problems that? Because I feel like sometimes we're just fighting the problem, not the root cause of the issue.
Okay.
If we can even really define what the actual cause is.
Well, the whole thing about it is, I'm not necessarily a climate change denier. Climate change is, whether it's man-made or whether it's not. But I also think the debate is settled in the direction where it's going and what exactly the problem is, to put this warns people into a libertarian perspective for our listeners. When you think of what happens when the Federal Reserve inflates the money supply, well, eventually when people reestablish their time preferences, the artificial boom will turn to bust. So we have something that we don't like, the bust, that we know it's the inevitable thing to happen, so we know what to do to prevent it. With climate change, it's kind of like, yeah, it's happening, but what eventually will happen? Because I think what Kim said, we were supposed to already have been dead, depending on who you listen to and which, peer-reviewed, accredited climate scientists you listen to, there are so many different things about what the end result could be, and they've all either been wrong. I don't know what to make of it. What is so bad about it? It's one thing to say this is happening. It's another thing to think that if in 200 years the world temperature rises a couple of degrees, what are the long-term effects to that? And it's just kind of silly to think that humans won't have reached a point, especially through advancements in liberty being conducive to free markets and innovation and competition and all these other things and rising standards of living, that we won't be able to combat that at that time either. And who knows?
Should we be investing in all these? I mean, I think they did a study by NASA that found that the actual solar or polar ice caps are actually growing, not decreasing.
Well, all right. So let me say exactly what's wrong with that right now. So our global warming, the ice caps melted, and of course they are growing back, and they are growing back larger, but that's because the salt that's in the ice is being melted, and then that water refreezes without the salt because it's left in on the bottom of the seafloor. So that's actually a red herring that a lot of politicians are saying and putting out there.
The ice cover is expanding, but the total amount of ice is decreasing.
I'm just saying, I was like, nobody that hasn't been alive on the Earth more than a few years is going to deny there's climate change. But I'm just saying, it's about as good as a governmental political scare tactic as, they're coming to steal your guns. It works. It works really well. I know plenty
of people who are climate change deniers.
But I mean, according to Al Gore, we're in a massive Holocaust.
Oh yeah, guys. Oh yeah. So yeah, well, it works for one person.
I mean, there's a guy that's at the University of Arizona State University who says in 30 years the humans are gonna die.
It's not just Al Gore. I mean, he had teams of scientists on this. I mean, did you guys ever? I remember in high school they made us watch The Inconvenient Truth. And it's a pretty scary movie. I mean, if you look at what the real message is of it.
Hey, have you guys seen his slideshow, the updated version after, you know, it was proved wrong? That was fun too.
I'll have to check that out.
And you know, it's not just some guy. I mean, he was vice president.
I shook his hand once. It was fun. It was that like a jazz band thing. It's interesting.
That wasn't him. It was Man Bear Pig.
Oh, Man Bear Pig.
How long has this one been going, Kim?
We're headed into an hour and 23 minutes. Isn't that fun?
Oh, that's about as long as episode 2. Do you want to, because this is the first time we've had you on, and this kind of me, Kim, and Tim, we would all be considered staunch libertarians. You know, Thurman is probably the most newborn, going back to the title of the suit, newborn libertarian here, you know, still doing some research. But it's nice to have someone on here who, you know, challenges our beliefs and comes to the table with something of substance to actually talk about and have a constructive discussion. Do you want to go into banking and income inequality specifically, or an Occupy Wall Street movement, or?
Yeah, we can touch on that. I'd be interested. I have some thoughts on income inequality. My grasp on economic theory and, you know, the lingo that goes along with that is, that's not my strongest suit. I just talked to Tim last night, and he was like, hey, do you want to come on? I was like, okay, yeah, absolutely. But if I had a little bit more time, I could prep something probably for it, do a little research. But
you know, by no means are we all professionals at every subject here.
I'm more into like theoretical. We just
want to talk about what people our age would be talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. No, yeah, I'd be interested in talking about those things. For sure.
Cool.
So, I think, do we want to do the next episode? Do we want to do like history of economic thought and schools of economic thought, or do we want to do try to do feminism next? You know, because we didn't have Amy, but we did have David, and David said that he kind of considers himself a feminist. So we could. Which one do we want to do first? Do we want to do economics or feminism?
I think I'd be more interested in economic schools of thought.
Got one for econ.
I like both, but I prefer feminism, I guess, because we did a lot of economic talk tonight, too.
Yeah, I could do either one.
Yeah, either one's fine.
Okay, so if either one's fine and Thurman wants to do economics, and I kind of want to do economics, I'm not going to lie. economics, that'd be actually a really good time, I think, to discuss income inequality and the role kind of central banking has in that. We could talk about Occupy Wall Street. Because I think Occupy Wall Street started as a good thing, but it's like kind of hijacked, kind of like every Arab Spring movement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to lie, I like talking about economics, so I can dive a little deeper into, so I've been talking to some feminists and getting a little, I've found some interesting stuff, so I have like a little bit longer, so we can have a nice talk about that, so I think it'd be exciting, so. I would prefer the economics for now, so I can have something more meaty for the feminism.
Are we all satisfied here?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. No one's angry. This isn't like Facebook.
Well.
Look, I'm going to go into my safe space. I'm offended.
Oh, okay.
We can all go back to yelling at each other in print.
Yeah, it's more.
As long as it's done in proper English.
I'll hide behind my screen.
Ooh, Kim, you know, okay, so about that proper English thing. I had a guy who listened to the second podcast episode. Shout out to Josh Wainer. He's an anthropologist, and apparently Ebonics, you know, of course, a lot of people know it's an actual language now, you know, what people call.
Yeah, I remember that.
Not proper English.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a model of a language, or a couple of languages in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, I was aware of that. And I was like, I'm also not really African.
Okay.
I was like, I'm all like, I was never born in Africa. I'm American. I was born in America. Don't really know what I can do about that.
Okay. Well, never mind then.
Hey, does anyone have like a cool idea we can all do this episode to kind of wrap up with? Maybe like a, I don't know, something light, funny. I don't know. Just find the funniest thing you saw on Facebook, or ooh, let's do this. The funniest meme you saw about Donald Trump in the last few years.
Oh my God. I was just about to bring him up. You know, he really is. Like, I just made the realization this morning. He's like Hitler, dude. Like, I don't know. I've been seeing a whole bunch of memes on Facebook, like where they have like on the left side, they show all the main reasons how Hitler like rose to power and everything. And then on the right side, it's Donald Trump. And it's the list of all the same things.
He's just the guy who's retweeting Hitler.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm not a fan of God. Like, okay, like my friend Franco always says, you know, not a fan of Godwin's Law, but this is too funny. You know, Donald Trump kind of is the right's Godwin Law reaction to the political debate. Like, eventually, with all the politics going back and forth throughout the years, eventually you'd get to Hitler, and that's kind of Donald Trump.
What is Godwin Law?
Every internet discussion eventually devolves into someone calling the other person's views just like Hitler.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
They either say Hitler or they just say you're a Nazi.
I'm not even worried about Trump, though. Like, I don't take him seriously. He's so unelectable and in general that... Like, I know there's kind of a thing about, maybe he's in collusion with Hillary. I don't necessarily buy that. I think, honestly, like, what he's doing is actually much more beneficial to people like Bush and Rubio, who are likely to become the nominee, because when you look at Carson, he's unfucking electable. Sorry, I don't know if I should swear. He's scarier than Trump, if that's possible. Because Trump, I don't even believe what Trump's saying. I don't believe half the things that come out of his mouth. I think he's just, like, I think we could trade him all this for, like, a TV show of his own. But I don't believe he'd actually do the thing. Like, he's not going to build a wall, so, like, what do I care?
It's the media. They think the poll numbers mean something. The poll numbers he's leading in them, that totally means that people are going to elect him. Poll numbers.
Right. Oh, he's not going to be the... I kind of picture, like... I picture some smart strategist sitting around in a room somewhere right now being like, what the hell do we have to, like, have Trump say to get, like, the rest of the base to reject him so we can put the real nominee in place? Because I think he's just making people like Rubio look moderate, even though they're the same.
Right.
He's going to Rubio appeal to them. Because the election comes down to the independents. And, you know, that's like, what, 8 to 10% of the population. Those people are not going to vote for Trump. They're not going to vote for Carson. And the Republican leadership knows that. They're not stupid.
I think they might vote for Trump. people tend to just listen to what he says instead of what he...
Over. So.
You guys aren't in Oklahoma. You don't understand how much support there is for Trump. It's here.
It's here in Texas too.
It's scary, but what kind of, I guess you'd call a silver lining about Trump, he kind of seems content to let Russia take on ISIS and just kind of withdraw from there, but I don't know if he'd really do that. On economics, Trump is terrible. He's like a mercantilist, like a mercantilist, imperialist, colonialist, whatever you want to call it. It's really, really scary. But yeah, I agree. I think Carson, you know, he pulls a lot of the religious people who think that we should stand up for whatever and always find someone to fight, which is kind of what the conservative base has turned into.
Oh, whether it's him,
Rubio would also be terrible. Rubio would get us into World War III. Maybe Ted Cruz is a dark horse. I know a lot of paleo libertarians and kind of constitutional conservatives like him, and he seems to be going after Ron Paul's vote, but he's still talk, and supposedly Rand Paul has this great ground campaign that's not kicked in yet that never seems to show up. It's kind of like the Jackalope.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just never, like, I'm a big Rand Paul guy, but I know a few people who really support him, but it's just not, you know, you're not getting the numbers that I think he's wanting.
Yeah.
And I think it boils down to marketing and kind of getting with the root of the messages.
It's so weird, though, with Paul, though, because when you go into, like, the Fox News website, so it has all the candidates listed, and didn't have Rand Paul listed, but when you vote for it, in what, the leader was, like 21, but then had, like, 37. You put Rand Paul's name in there, Rand Paul looked up something, so I don't know, maybe it's true.
No, yeah, we might not know until, you know, we show up to cast our vote. I mean, the media hiding certain candidates is not a new thing. We, you know, you see Bernie Sanders get almost no credit on, you know, CNN.
It is all you see on social media.
Right, exactly. Everything's Bernie this, Bernie that. I mean,
it's like the news is out of, I think the news is out of touch on this one. Like, I think CNN and New York Times are wrong to be trumping Hillary, like, touting Hillary as a done deal. I think it's a lot more up in the air.
Yeah. I mean, I would say most media is out of touch.
Yeah, no, I agree.
There are a lot of, Sanders seems to attract a lot of the younger people. Social media is a little bit more developed than the platform has been since Ron Paul ran his campaigns. But it's just, you know, I don't support Bernie Sanders, but I'm just waiting for the inevitable moment where these people realize the establishment gypped them, like they gypped Ron Paul, how they hid him, stole delegates, and did all those other things. Especially if Hillary Clinton is the opposition, you know, she's killed people. So, who knows?
And I'm still...
I'm surprised, too. Every time I talk to... It seems like every time I talk to a liberal lately who isn't on social media, isn't in touch, they're just like, we're all voting for Hillary, right?
And
I don't know. I don't think so. It doesn't look like that way. I think Hillary's a corporate shill. I think she's not as good as a... I mean, I like and dislike parts of Obama, but I think she'd be slightly worse, but mostly the same.
No, she'd be worse. She'd be 10 times the hawk Obama was.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
About all this. So all this talk of World War III is a boon to the Republicans because hawkish candidates do a lot better in times where everyone's like, shit, are we going to war or not? Like, so, yeah, it'll be interesting. This is, I've been telling people for a while, like, starting last year, I was like, this election cycle is going to be like Christmas for me for a whole year.
So, in what way?
Just that there's so much to input or intake and just so
yeah,
much.
Yeah, we... We are getting a full spectrum of candidates here.
Yeah, it's just... But I could see that coming like a year ago, and so I was like, this is going to be a dick.
I'm just going to have to ask a question if I should have hit the stop button any time ago, because I think Thurman's like washing dishes and stuff. So I'm like wondering if the listener's like, what the hell is going on? There's like dishwashing, door closing, all sorts of crap going on in the background right now. So
somebody
maybe we should end the show.
Right through the apartment.
Yeah, Thurman's getting phone calls. He's probably got an office in
like
there.
Like, glasses breaking and stuff. Like, if listeners probably were like, I gotta turn this off, man. I don't know what they're doing. House cleaning or something going on?
It's fine.
My bad.
Obviously a brothel.
So, it's Las Vegas. See, free market, man. I'm trying to, like, entertain the whores, man. Come on. Oh, sorry, sex workers. Oh, God.
You sexist, Kim.
Undocumented sex workers.
The worst.
No, come on. They have contracts with me. Come on. I need my monies. Anyway.
I would say anybody who's not super religious would agree with that.
Yeah. I think we're all here for prostitution being legalized.
Yeah, let's get down to the real subject that we all came here to talk about.
So, I'm with David when he says prostitution should be legalized and regulated because it's not legalized right now. But as soon as it's legalized and regulated, you can make darn sure you're not taking any money out of those sex workers' paychecks because.
But how do you I mean, if you regulate that, you're just going to get people complaining about controlling your body.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right now there's no protection for them. There's no legal recourse if the workers are taken advantage of, and you know, obviously, we'd all like them to be in a more morally and
safe environment, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, they're still taking advantage of now, sadly.
What's that?
They're still being taken advantage of.
But I think people who use prostitutes are probably not worried too much about protection. Well, otherwise they wouldn't be sleeping with people who sleep with many people.
I'm not so concerned about the people that are visiting the prostitutes. I'm more concerned about the prostitutes right about now because I'm not sure.
Well, they do their homework. Like in Australia where they have some of those high-end brothels and you get screened, you get this and you get that. They make sure. I mean, when you legalize it and you end prohibition, you take it out of the shadows, the black market becomes a lot less black and puts it in the hands of undesirables. It puts it in the hands of, you know, legitimate business people who may or may not have different ethical standards.
Thank you. There you go, Christian. You stepped right into where I was trying to lead someone. Thank you.
Yeah, but we're... See? I mean, hopefully we'll find that if it was to be legalized, you know, there is actual, you know, rights for these, you know, prostitutes who should feel safe in whatever course of, you know, career they choose. But as we know, that the people who, you know, the pimps and these aren't valuable people in society. You know, these people mistreat many times these prostitutes. They trick them. You know, I watched a whole documentary on this. It was actually on Netflix. Can't remember what it's called, but you know, a lot of these poor girls actually get tricked into it. Not, you know, it's not them deciding, hey, this is my body. And, you know, if I want to sell my body for, you know, money, I have that right. You know, a lot of times, you know, people are, you know, kidnapped. And actually one girl got lured into coming to Vegas. And next thing she knew, she was calling her parents, pretending like everything was okay. And, you know, she's hopped up on drugs and all this stuff. You know, I think it's a difference between making sure that the people who are doing this truly want to do this instead of being taken advantage of.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're saying, like, in order to prevent the coercion of them by these pimps, it needs to be, like, they need to have some kind of legal recourse where they can go to a, you know, police station and be like, this person is taking advantage of me and coercing me, and right now they're just not getting that. So.
Well, you know, if it's
they'll be arrested for being a prostitute.
Yeah, that's the problem. Like, if we take away that stigma, the problem of, you know, you can't be, it's illegal to be a prostitute. And you're like, well, it's not like I tried to be a prostitute, fool. So.
Hey, do we want to wrap up now? Or
yeah, it's probably a good idea. We're about to hit 1 minute. Well, 1 minute, 1 hour and 40 minutes.
Cool. I just want to say thanks to Dave, our new guest. We'd like to have him on as often as he wants to come on. I feel like we're growing. Eventually, if we get to the point where we have 7 or 8 people, we might have to start a rotation or something on different topics that people are interested in. But yeah, I'm glad to see us getting more people. I'm glad to see people downloading. And please write a review on iTunes or something like that. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, what you hate. Rag on all of us if you want. That's okay, as long as we know you're listening.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Thurman, Tim, Kim, for having me on. You know, Kim's the rock here with the equipment. David, thanks for coming on and enduring us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for tolerating me.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about all that tolerance some other time.
Yeah. Who will? Kim, you want to
Yes.
say anything? Tell us where they can find us on social media.
Yes, let's be clear. I'm pretty sure I'm the weird, annoying one. That's always my role in everything. If you want to send us any comments, anything, you can send us email. You can even record something. You can send us a little voice message and attach that via email. You can send that to newbornlibertarian@gmail.com. Tweet at us at Newborn Liberty. And you can also find the Facebook group. Just search out Newborn Libertarian. And our next show apparently is going to be on economic theory. I guess all schools of economic theory. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I think we just go through a quick history of economic thought and explore business cycles and basic concepts.
Okay. All right, then. Well, until next time, thanks for listening, guys.